A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about freedom of movement for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and he framed it around a moment of realization. He'd see Muslims at Ben Gurion Airport and assume they were Palestinians from the territories. Turns out, they were almost certainly Israeli Arabs. Palestinians can't use Ben Gurion, they use the airport in Amman. So the question is, how hard is it, practically, for a Palestinian in the West Bank or Gaza to travel anywhere? What does booking a flight to Istanbul actually look like, step by step? And what about somewhere outside the Muslim world, like the US?
The first thing to nail down is the distinction Daniel's already spotted. Israeli Arabs, Palestinian citizens of Israel, hold Israeli passports. They move through Ben Gurion like any other Israeli citizen. Palestinians in the occupied territories hold a completely different document, the Palestinian Authority passport, and they operate under a completely different legal framework. The PA passport is issued by the Palestinian Authority, which isn't a sovereign state. It's recognized by about 40 countries, Turkey, Brazil, South Africa, Jordan, several Arab League states, but not by the United States, not by most of Europe, not by Canada, not by Japan.
It's a passport that about 150 countries look at and say, that's not a passport.
That's functionally what it is. The PA passport has an ICAO-compliant design. Machine-readable, biometric, in newer versions. But recognition is a political decision, not a technical one. If a country doesn't recognize the state of Palestine, it typically doesn't recognize the travel document either. And even when a country does recognize it, the passport alone doesn't get you anywhere. You still need somewhere to depart from, and that's where the geography gets brutal.
Let's map this out. You're a Palestinian in the West Bank. You want to fly to Istanbul. Step one is not booking a flight. Step one is figuring out how you physically leave the West Bank.
There are three exit points that matter. Ben Gurion Airport, effectively off-limits. The Allenby Bridge crossing, also called the King Hussein Bridge, which connects the West Bank to Jordan. And for Gazans, the Rafah crossing into Egypt, which has been closed since May of 2024. So right now, for almost all West Bank Palestinians, there's one route, cross into Jordan, then fly from Queen Aliya International Airport in Amman. For Gazans, the only exit since Rafah closed is the Erez crossing into Israel, which requires permits from both Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and those are essentially impossible to get unless you're a humanitarian case.
The West Bank to Jordan pipeline is the main story here. Walk me through the Allenby crossing.
Allenby is a strange creature. It's technically a border crossing between the Palestinian territories and Jordan, but it's fully controlled by Israel on the West Bank side. Israel doesn't claim sovereignty over the West Bank, but it controls every entry and exit point. The crossing operates from 7 in the morning to 7 in the evening, but those hours are aspirational. Closures happen. Security alerts, holidays, administrative decisions. Before October 2023, Allenby processed about 5,000 people a day. Now it's closer to 2,000, with wait times that can stretch from 2 to 6 hours.
2 to 6 hours just to get through the crossing.
That's after you've secured the documents that let you approach the crossing at all. A Palestinian in Ramallah who wants to fly to Istanbul first needs an Israeli exit permit. This is a specific permission slip issued by the Israeli Civil Administration. The application goes through the Palestinian Authority's Civil Affairs Ministry, which forwards it to the Israeli side. Processing takes 5 to 10 working days. The permit specifies your travel dates, your destination, and the crossing point. You don't show up to Allenby without one.
If you're denied,
you can appeal, but the process is opaque. Denials are common. Security grounds are the usual reason, and security grounds are not explained. There's no public appeals board with published rulings. You wait and reapply, or you don't go.
Let's say you get the permit. You arrive at Allenby.
The crossing uses a back-to-back system. You get off your vehicle on the West Bank side, go through Israeli security, biometric registration, baggage screening, interview questions, and once cleared, you walk or take a bus across to the Jordanian side. Your luggage gets transferred separately. You go through Jordanian customs and immigration, and then you're in Jordan. At that point, you still have to get to Queen Alia Airport, about 30 kilometers south of Amman. The crossing itself is near Jericho, so you're looking at roughly an hour's drive from the border to the airport.
Now we get to the passport question. Because when you check in at Queen Alia, you're not just handing over one document.
This is where the dual passport reality kicks in. Roughly 70% of West Bank Palestinians also hold Jordanian passports. Jordan issued these broadly after annexing the West Bank in 1948 and continued issuing them after 1967, but with restrictions. The Jordanian passport held by a West Bank Palestinian is typically temporary, valid for 2 to 5 years, and it does not confer citizenship in the full sense. It doesn't give you the right to work or vote in Jordan. It's a travel document, not a membership card.
Like a gym pass that only lets you walk through the lobby.
That's actually not far off. And here's the complication. When a Palestinian with a Jordanian passport enters Jordan, they're not entering as a citizen returning home. They're entering as a temporary passport holder, which means Jordanian immigration can still question them, limit their stay, or deny entry. Most cross without issue, but the legal status is precarious. Now, at the airline check-in counter in Amman, you present both passports, the PA passport and the Jordanian passport. The PA passport is your identity document. The Jordanian passport is your travel document. Turkish Airlines, for example, will want to see that you have a valid visa or visa on arrival eligibility for Turkey. PA passport holders can get an e-visa. Jordanian passport holders can enter Turkey visa-free. So in theory, either passport works for the destination. But the airline cares about the document chain. The airline is legally responsible for making sure every passenger has valid entry documents for the destination country. Under IATA rules, airlines face fines of up to $10,000 per passenger for transporting someone with improper documentation. And it's not just the fine. The airline also has to fly the passenger back at its own expense. So airlines are extremely risk-averse. If a check-in agent sees a PA passport, they may not know that Turkey accepts it. They may not have an up-to-date entry in their system. If anything looks unusual, they deny boarding. It's safer for the airline to say no than to say yes and get it wrong.
You've crossed a militarized border, waited hours, driven to Amman, and an airline check-in agent can still say, "I don't like the look of this," and your trip is over.
There was a lawsuit in 2025 against Royal Jordanian Airlines. A Palestinian family with valid Jordanian passports and valid U.S. visas was denied boarding. The airline cited additional verification requirements from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The family had done everything right. The airline still refused them. The case is ongoing, but it illustrates the core problem. The system delegates border enforcement to commercial actors who have every incentive to err on the side of exclusion.
The airline has border guard.
And this isn't unique to Palestinians. It's built into the architecture of international travel. But for Palestinians, the effect is magnified because their documents are unusual. A temporary Jordanian passport held by a Palestinian is not something a check-in agent sees every day. If they hesitate, if they call a supervisor, if the supervisor calls someone who doesn't answer, you're not flying.
Let's go back to Gaza, because the West Bank situation is difficult, but at least there's a pipeline. Gaza has no pipeline right now.
Gaza is a different category of restriction. Since May 2024, the Rafah crossing into Egypt has been closed. That was the primary exit for Gazans. Always heavily controlled, always requiring coordination between the Palestinian Authority and the Egyptian government, but functional. Before the closure, Gazans who wanted to travel registered with the Palestinian side, which maintained a wait list. Egypt controlled how many people could cross per day. The numbers were never high, a few hundred on a good day, sometimes none. You could wait months. Medical patients, students with foreign university acceptances, people with residency visas for other countries got priority. Everyone else waited. Now the only exit from Gaza is Erez crossing into Israel. Erez requires a permit from both Israel and the Palestinian Authority. These permits are essentially restricted to humanitarian cases, medical treatment mostly, and even those are difficult. If you're a Gazan who wants to visit family in Turkey, there is no process. The system does not accommodate that category of traveler.
For Gazans, the question of booking a flight to Istanbul is almost hypothetical. The answer is, you can't get out to reach the airport.
Right now, correct. And even when Rafah was open, travel was extremely limited, but the closure has eliminated even the narrow pathway that existed.
Let's pivot to destinations. We've talked about getting to Amman and flying to Istanbul. What about the United States?
This is where the barriers compound dramatically. Let's take two people living 20 kilometers apart, one in Nablus, in the West Bank, and one in Nazareth, inside Israel. Both are Palestinian. Both want to visit the United States. Both apply for a B2 tourist visa at the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
Same embassy. Same forms.
Same building, same DS-160 form, same application fee, and completely different outcomes. The person from Nazareth holds an Israeli passport. The denial rate for Israeli citizens is low, around 5-6% in recent years. The person from Nablus holds a PA passport. They face a denial rate that was 67% in fiscal year 2025, according to State Department data. That's compared to a global average of 22%.
67%. 2 out of 3 denied.
The denial is almost always under Section 24 Pornball of the Immigration and Nationality Act, failure to demonstrate sufficient ties to a residence abroad that would compel return. For a Palestinian applicant, that's a brutal standard. You live under occupation. Your economy is constrained. You may not have stable employment or property ownership in a form the consular officer recognizes. The very conditions that make someone want to travel, limited opportunity, political instability, are the conditions that make the consular officer suspect you'll overstay.
The visa process filters for people who are already embedded in a stable life, which is exactly what the broader situation makes difficult.
That's the trap. And it's not unique to Palestinians. It's how 204B works globally. But the baseline conditions in the West Bank and Gaza make it exceptionally hard to satisfy. The officer isn't required to prove you'll overstay. You're required to prove you won't. The burden is entirely on the applicant, and the evidence that would satisfy it is often unavailable.
There's also the ESTA question.
ESTA, the Electronic System for Travel Authorization, is a visa waiver program available to citizens of about 40 countries. It is not available to PA passport holders. It is not available to holders of temporary Jordanian passports. So every Palestinian traveler to the U.S. needs a visa, which means the interview, the wait, the 67% denial rate. There's no shortcut.
What about applying for a U.S. visa at an embassy in a third country rather than Jerusalem?
It's theoretically possible, but practically rare. You'd need to be physically present in that third country, which means you've already solved the exit problem. If you're a West Bank Palestinian who's managed to get to Amman, you could in principle apply at the U.S. embassy there. But the embassy will ask why you're not applying in Jerusalem, where you reside. If the answer is because I think I'll have a better chance here, that's not a winning argument. Consular officers are trained to spot forum shopping, and if you're denied in Amman, that denial follows you. There's no reset button.
The system is stacked. Physical barriers, bureaucratic barriers, diplomatic barriers, commercial barriers. Let's talk about the diplomatic layer specifically, because the PA passport's recognition status isn't static.
It's shifting slowly. The Palestinian Authority announced in March of this year that it's moving toward ICAO-compliant biometric passports, full e-passport standard, with embedded chips and digital signatures. That's a technical upgrade that makes the document harder to forge and easier for automated systems to verify. The hope on the Palestinian side is that technical compliance will drive political recognition. If the passport passes every machine readability test, the argument goes, more countries will accept it as a valid travel document.
Does that actually work? Does a better passport change the politics?
The EU's upcoming entry-exit system and its travel authorization system, ETIAS, both delayed to 2027, will apply to PA passport holders. The question is how those systems will verify a PA passport. If the passport is ICAO compliant and the EU recognizes it for processing purposes, that creates a technical pathway for travel to Europe, even if the political recognition isn't formalized. But technical pathway doesn't mean open borders. It means the passport gets read by a machine. The visa requirement remains. The background checks remain. The airline still has to decide whether to board you.
Better tech reduces one layer of friction but leaves the others intact.
It's not clear how many layers need to shift before the experience actually changes for a traveler. You could have a fully ICAO-compliant biometric passport and still be denied boarding by a risk-averse airline. You could have a valid U.S. visa and still be stopped at Allenby. The system isn't a single gate, it's a stack of gates, and any one of them can close.
That's the systemic insight here. Freedom of movement isn't one thing you either have or don't. It's a stack. Physical crossings, bureaucratic permits, passport recognition, visa regimes, airline liability rules. Each layer compounds the others. And for Palestinians, every layer is contested.
Let me give you another concrete layer, the airline liability regime itself. The IATA travel rules date back to the Warsaw Convention, but the core principle is that the carrier is responsible for verifying documents. The fines, up to $10,000 per passenger, are only part of it. The airline also bears the cost of repatriation. If a passenger is denied entry at Istanbul, Turkish Airlines flies them back to Amman at the airline's expense. If it happens repeatedly, the airline can lose landing rights or face additional scrutiny, so airlines build their own verification systems on top of the official ones. They subscribe to databases like Tematic, which aggregates entry requirements for every country. But Tematic is only as good as its data, and for unusual documents like a temporary Jordanian passport, the data may be incomplete or conflicting.
The check-in agent isn't just reading a screen that says yes or no. They're interpreting incomplete information under time pressure, with a line of passengers behind them, knowing that a mistake could cost their employer 10 grand and a repatriation flight.
The rational response to that incentive structure is to deny boarding whenever there's ambiguity. The cost of a false negative, denying a valid passenger, is an angry customer and maybe a complaint. The cost of a false positive, boarding an invalid passenger, is a fine, a repatriation cost, and potential regulatory trouble. The asymmetry is massive.
That's the commercial layer doing the work of border enforcement without anyone having to write a law that says keep Palestinians out. You just design an incentive structure where the rational business decision is exclusion.
It's not targeted. The system doesn't say deny Palestinians. It says deny anyone whose documents you can't verify with confidence. But Palestinians, as a category, have documents that are harder to verify with confidence. The PA passport is recognized by 40-ish countries. The Jordanian temporary passport is an unusual variant. The combination creates ambiguity, and ambiguity triggers denial.
Let's zoom out for a moment. If you're a Palestinian in the West Bank who wants to travel, what's the most reliable route? What actually works?
The most reliable route? And I want to emphasize that reliable here means least likely to fail, not guaranteed, is via Amman with a valid Jordanian passport and a pre-approved visa for the destination country. You apply for the Israeli exit permit well in advance. You cross at Allenby, accepting that the wait could be hours. You fly from Queen Alia with an airline that has clear, published acceptance policies for your documents. Turkish Airlines is generally familiar with Palestinian travelers on this route. You carry both passports, you carry printed copies of your visa approval, your hotel bookings and itinerary, and you arrive at the airport early. Even then, a check-in agent can say no.
If you're going to the U.S. specifically.
Then you add the visa interview at the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, where you'll face the 67% denial rate. If you clear that, you have a visa in your PA passport, which helps. It signals that the U.S. government has already vetted you. But the airline still needs to verify the visa, and the visa in a PA passport may trigger additional checks. The CBP system will flag it. The airline may call the Regional Carrier Liaison Group, a CBP unit that advises airlines on document validity. That call can take hours. If your connection in Amman is tight, you miss it.
Even with a U.S. visa stamped in your passport, you can still be denied boarding because the verification process takes too long.
That's the distributed nature of the system. No single actor is saying this person cannot travel. The Israeli exit permit says you can leave. The Jordanian passport says you can transit. The U.S. visa says you can enter. But the airline has to stitch those documents together in real time under liability pressure with incomplete information. The system works when all the pieces align and everyone says yes quickly. It fails when anyone hesitates.
The document chain integrity problem?
A single mismatch. Your Jordanian passport has a slightly different name, transliteration, than your PA passport. Your visa was issued under one passport number, but you're traveling on another, can cascade into denial. The most careful travelers carry both passports, match all their bookings to the passport they'll present at each checkpoint, and bring documentation for every link in the chain. It's logistics work that travelers from recognized states never have to think about.
I want to go back to the 67% denial rate for U.S. visas. What are consular officers actually looking at?
The Section 214B standard is ties to a residence abroad. The consular officer assesses whether the applicant has sufficient economic, social, and family connections to their home country that they're likely to return. The factors include employment, property ownership, family situation, travel history, and general conditions in the home country. For a Palestinian applicant, several of these factors are structurally difficult to demonstrate. Employment in the West Bank is constrained by the occupation, movement restrictions, and access to resources. Property ownership exists, but proving it can be complicated by the legal patchwork of land registration. Travel history is itself limited by the movement restrictions we've been describing. It's hard to show a history of compliant travel when you've never been able to travel.
You need travel history to get a visa, but you need a visa to build travel history.
The consular officer's manual doesn't have a carve-out for applicant faces, structural barriers to meeting this standard. The standard is the standard. The officer has discretion, and some officers use it, but the institutional incentive is to apply the rules consistently, and the rules produce a 67% denial rate.
What about Israeli Arabs applying from Nazareth or Haifa? Same Palestinian identity, different passport.
Israeli passport holders have a completely different profile. They have the full rights of Israeli citizenship. They can demonstrate employment in the Israeli economy, property ownership under Israeli law, and, crucially, they can show a travel history. They've been through Ben Gurion. They've visited Europe, Turkey, maybe the U.S. before. Their passport is recognized everywhere. The consular officer sees a low overstay risk because the applicant has a stable life in a recognized state with a strong economy. The denial rate for Israeli citizens is in the single digits. Same ethnicity, same region, completely different outcome, because the passport and the legal framework it represents are what the system is actually reading.
The system isn't reading identity, it's reading documentation. And documentation is a proxy for state recognition, and state recognition is political.
The PA passport is recognized by countries that recognize the state of Palestine. The U.S. doesn't, so the U.S. treats the PA passport as a travel document issued by an entity it doesn't fully recognize, which triggers additional scrutiny. That scrutiny lands on the individual applicant, who has to overcome a presumption of ineligibility that citizens of recognized states don't face.
Let's talk about what this looks like from the travel industry side. If you work in travel tech or logistics, this is a systems design problem. You have a set of travelers with unusual document profiles, crossing points with unpredictable hours, and airlines with extreme risk aversion. What would a better system look like?
This is where the World Customs Organization's SAFE framework comes in. It's a set of standards for securing and facilitating global trade and travel, and it includes provisions for digital identity and advanced passenger information. The idea is that if travelers can be pre-vetted digitally, their documents verified, their risk assessed, before they even reach the airport, the airline's liability calculation changes. The carrier isn't making a split-second decision at the check-in counter. They're receiving a pre-authorized clearance from a trusted system.
Does that help Palestinians specifically?
Potentially, if the digital identity system recognizes PA passports and temporary Jordanian passports as valid inputs. But that's the political question again. Digital identity systems are built by states and for states. If a state doesn't recognize the PA passport, its digital identity system won't either. The technology can reduce friction at the commercial layer, the airline's decision, but it can't override the diplomatic layer. A check-in agent in Amman might get a green light from a digital system instead of having to interpret ambiguous documents, but the green light only happens if the system has been told to recognize those documents.
We're back to the stack. Better tech fixes one layer but leaves the others intact. The diplomatic layer, recognition, is the one that gates everything else.
Recognition is slow. The PA passport is recognized by about 40 countries today. That number has grown over the years, but the countries that don't recognize it, the U.S., Canada, most of Europe, Japan, Australia, are the destinations that most travelers want to reach. so the passport opens doors to countries that are either neighbors or politically aligned, but not to the global north. If you're a Palestinian who wants to study at a university in London, your PA passport is not enough. You need a visa, and you need the UK to accept your PA passport as a valid document for visa issuance, which it does, but with restrictions and additional requirements. It's possible, but it's not straightforward.
We haven't even talked about the cost. All of this, the permits, the crossing fees, the dual passports, the visa applications, the flights from Amman instead of Tel Aviv, it adds up.
The economic dimension is significant. A flight from Amman to Istanbul is more expensive than the equivalent flight from Tel Aviv, partly because Queen Alia is a smaller hub with fewer routes. The exit permit application has associated fees. The Jordanian passport renewal, every 2 to 5 years, costs money. The U.S. visa application fee is $185, non-refundable, regardless of outcome. For a family of four applying for U.S. visas with a 67% denial rate, that's $740 in application fees alone, with a high probability that most or all will be denied. These are not trivial sums in the West Bank economy.
The barriers aren't just physical and bureaucratic. They're financial. Travel is expensive for everyone, but for Palestinians, you're paying more for less certainty, and you're paying for applications that will probably fail.
You're paying in time. The Allenby crossing can consume an entire day. The exit permit process eats up 2 weeks. The visa interview wait time at the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem is typically several weeks to months. A trip that a Tel Aviv resident plans in a week might take a Ramallah resident 2 months of preparation, with no guarantee of success at the end.
I want to circle back to something from the prompt. Daniel mentioned seeing Muslims at Ben-Gurion and assuming they were Palestinians. That assumption is interesting because it reflects how invisible these barriers are to an outsider. You see a diverse crowd at an airport and assume the system is open. You don't see the people who aren't there.
Ben-Gurion served about 25 million passengers in 2023. The number of Palestinians from the West Bank who used it under permit was negligible. A few thousand, mostly VIPs, business people with special authorization, and medical cases. The vast majority of the Muslim travelers Daniel saw were Israeli Arabs, who are about 20% of Israel's population and move through the airport like any other citizen. The Palestinians who might have been there simply weren't.
The absence is the story.
It's an absence that compounds across destinations. If you can't get to the airport, you can't fly. If you can't fly, you can't visit family abroad, attend conferences, study at foreign universities, seek medical treatment, or do any of the things that international travel enables. The restriction on movement isn't just an inconvenience. It's a constraint on every dimension of life that requires crossing a border.
What's the forward look? The PA is pushing for ICAO-compliant biometric passports. The EU's EES and ETIS systems are coming. Does the situation improve, or do new barriers replace the old ones?
The honest answer is that nobody knows. The technology is moving toward more automated verification, which could reduce the airline discretion problem if the systems are configured to recognize PA documents. But technology can also create new barriers. Biometric systems require enrollment. What database does a PA passport holder get enrolled in? Who controls that database? If the system is built around state recognition and the state isn't recognized, the technology may simply encode the existing exclusion in a more efficient form.
Digital walls instead of physical ones.
The optimistic scenario is that technical compliance, ICAO standard biometric passports, integration with Interpol databases, advanced passenger information sharing creates a de facto recognition that opens doors. Countries that don't politically recognize Palestine might still accept the passport for travel purposes because the machine says it's valid. That's already happening to some degree. Several European countries accept the PA passport for visa processing even though they don't recognize the state of Palestine in a formal diplomatic sense. The document works at the administrative level even if the political level is unresolved.
The stack might get shorter. The diplomatic layer might thin out as the technical layer improves.
That's the hope. But the physical layer, the crossings, the permits, is not a technical problem. Allenby isn't slow because the computers are old. It's slow because the security regime is designed to be thorough, and thoroughness takes time, and the capacity is deliberately constrained. The exit permit system isn't a paperwork inefficiency that can be streamlined. It's a control mechanism. Those layers don't change just because the passport gets a chip.
To summarize what we've walked through, a Palestinian in the West Bank who wants to fly to Istanbul needs an Israeli exit permit, needs to cross Allenby during limited hours with unpredictable wait times, needs a Jordanian passport or a PA passport with Turkish Evisa, needs to get to Queen Alia Airport, and needs an airline check-in agent who doesn't flinch at their documents. If any link in that chain breaks, the trip doesn't happen. For a Gazan, the chain doesn't even exist right now. For a US destination, add a visa interview with a 67% denial rate, and an airline that may call CBP for additional verification. The whole system is a stack of gates, and every gate is designed to be hard to open.
The key insight, the thing that's easy to miss if you don't look closely, is that no single gate is insurmountable. The exit permit is obtainable, the crossing is passable, the visa is possible. The airline will board you if everything aligns. But the probability of all gates opening in sequence is the product of all the individual probabilities, and that product is low. Not zero. Palestinians do travel every day, but low enough that travel is a major undertaking rather than a routine activity.
For anyone listening who works in travel tech, logistics, or policy, the system's design question is worth sitting with. The current arrangement isn't optimized for security. It's optimized for exclusion. A secure system verifies identity and intent efficiently. This system verifies identity and intent through layers of redundancy that create exclusion as a byproduct. And the exclusion isn't random. It falls on a specific population with specific documents.
If you're building digital identity systems, advanced passenger information platforms, or airline verification tools, the question to ask is, does your system handle unusual documents gracefully, or does it default to denial when it encounters something it doesn't recognize? Because, for the traveler on the other end, that default is the difference between a trip that happens and a trip that ends at the check-in counter.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early Renaissance, artists in the Outer Hebrides attempting to depict the Aurora Borealis used a pigment made from crushed cobalt-bearing seaweed ash mixed with seal oil, producing a pale green that chemists now know was caused by trace copper ions in the local kelp species, a color that chemically has nothing whatsoever to do with the actual green of the aurora, which comes from excited atomic oxygen at roughly 100 to 250 kilometers altitude.
Right.
That was a lot of modifiers.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flemingtop for producing. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or search for My Weird Prompts on Spotify. We'll be back next week.
Go build something!
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.